Okay, so this is episode 8 of our podcast, but today we're going to actually be doing a special episode that we've been building up to, I feel like. Alexis, I think you had this idea at first, right?
Yeah, so the idea behind this episode was the Black Lives Matter was kind of resurging, and all these different resources were coming out. We were looking like as staff members and as friends as to what we could use and how we could kind of diversify some of the materials in our classrooms. And one of the books, and one of probably the most popular book I think right now is Stamped: Racism, Anti-Racism, and You by Jason Reynolds and Ibram X. Kendi. So as Melissa and I were starting this podcast, I thought it would be cool to have an episode where we talked about the book. And we invited two of our fellow coworkers and history teachers to read the book and come on the episode with us.
I'm going to just give like a brief the pull up from the book, and then if our guests want to introduce themselves, one is a previous guest and then one is a new one. But so the book itself, I believe, well, this is the young adult version, right? Because Ibram X. Kendi wrote Stamped from the beginning, and I haven't read that one, but I know that from the people that have read it, they said it's a lot more like convoluted and a lot more information packed. So I think we definitely went with the young adult version. As even like with Just Mercy, when I read that book, you were originally reading the massive one, and I was reading the young adult version. I was like, oh, it's such a quick read, it's so great. And you're like, no, I literally can't get past like chapter one. So I don't be put off by the fact that it's a young adult version. Like, that's just the thing that they're putting on it. Like, you can read it if you are a fully grown adult, it is fine.
Yes. Because even the young adult one, I had to like sit and digest a lot of the material in it. So.
So it says, this is not, it says, a timely, crucial, and empowering exploration of racism and anti-racism in America. This is not a history book. This is a book about the here and now, a book to help us better understand why we are where we are, a book about race. The construct of race has always been used to gain and keep power, to create dynamics that separate and silence. This remarkable reimagining of Dr. Ibram X. Kendi's National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning reveals the history of racist ideas in America and inspires hope for an anti-racist future. It takes you on a race journey from then to now, shows you why we feel how we feel, and why the poison of racism lingers. It also proves that while racist ideas have always been easy to fabricate and distribute, they can also be discredited. Through a gripping, fast-paced, and energizing narrative written by beloved award winner Jason Reynolds, this book shines a light on the many insidious forms of racist ideas and on ways readers can identify and stamp out racist thoughts in their daily lives. With that being said, we have John Rosser, who was our guest on last week's episode, who is a history teacher at Overbrook, and after much goading, finally admitted that he was also the basketball coach there.
I'm back.
And then we also have Mrs. Corey. So if you want to just introduce yourself, Mrs. Corey.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jennifer Corey, and I am a U.S. history teacher at the high school. My race is white, and I'm female, if you can't tell by my voice.
I guess the way that we broke this down is, as usual, we always compile a list of questions, and then we kind of gave our guests last minute the list of questions. But we also have Mr. Rosso shaking his head right now. We also have the books to reference.
Okay, so Stamped, as we were talking about, although the young adult version has so much information in it that it's hard to unpack it, and it will be different than any of our other episodes. Rosser and Jen, if you want to start, I don't care which one of you it is, but just what were your like initial reactions or thoughts to reading the book?
Once I got done, I just realized how eye-opening it all was between the films they went over, shows, even like historical figures that have been perceived as heroes, and how, like, for example, Martin Luther King, how they perceive them as be like an assimilationist instead of being anti-racist. And that, like, you're like, wait, MLK, like the guy we talk about like all the time, and he's like the man. And then it's like, It's very interesting the way he kind of breaks everything down and has a whole different spin on pretty much everything.
I guess if we want to segue, sorry, Jen, really quick off of that, if we want to go through what assimilation, the differences between, some of our listeners might not know the difference because to be...
And that's like a big like theme in the book, you know?
Yeah. Mm. And to be like totally honest, I did not know the difference until I read this book.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that I've ever heard it defined in those ways. Like, they really break it down so then they can label like people or ideas or things into those three mm-hmm. groups.
So I highlighted the very simplest way that they put it in the book, and it's on page 3. And it's segregationists, assimilationists, anti-racists. There are serious definitions to these things, but I'm going to give you mine. Segregationists are haters, like real haters, people who hate you for not being like them. Assimilationists are people who like you, but only with quotation marks, like you, meaning they like you because you're like them. And then there are anti-racists. They love you because you are like you. To go from there, Jen, your initial reactions.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading the book. And as a not at all young adult, I would consider myself old. It was like an easy read in his language and stuff like that. Like, it was easy to follow and easy to understand. So I think actually young adults can really understand it. And like Rosser said, it was just eye-opening. You know, I highlighted so many things. Like, the first, you know, half of the book is literally what I teach every single year. Well, let me rephrase that. It's not what I teach every single year. You know what I mean? It's like the years that I teach every single year, but there's so many things that can be added in. And, you know, instead of maybe like teaching one thing, you teach about, like, instead of teaching, you know, diving into the Declaration as much as we do, dive into Thomas Jefferson's life and the fact that he owned, you know, 600 slaves over the course of his life, you know, and kind of dive into that. So yeah, I thought it was really eye-opening. I thought it was really interesting and, you know, a quick read, but as you dive into it more, there's so many different layers to it.
I think it would be a cool book to use. Jen and I both teach U.S. History 1. In the past year, we've really been working on how to adapt our curriculum or, like, you know, focus on some other pieces of the time period that we teach. So U.S. 1 goes from colonial America to Reconstruction. So that's why she was saying in the first half of this book, it's all about that time period. So I was thinking, like, my thought on it, too, was you could use our Eurocentric written textbook we already have and pieces of stamped and to help create a fuller version. So like, how is Thomas Jefferson portrayed in this textbook and how was he portrayed in stamped? And then how can you use those pieces of information to create like a fuller picture of Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson? So I do think it like, in a way, complete some of what textbooks don't always have because you're just trying to focus on big names, big themes, and big events, and they're not always getting into all that nitty-gritty of like, yeah, Thomas Jefferson owned 600 mm-hmm. slaves, and he was always back and forth.
What really got me like hooked was that they were going so far back in history as like documenting what they were talking about as the first mm-hmm. racist and the whole story behind that and how it literally was all centered around like the justification of why it's okay to mm-hmm. own black people as slaves because of this from the history and how then that transferred over to ideals from Aristotle that he was, you know, saying that Greeks are the ultimate like race and no one's better than them. And then from there, the Puritans went and took Aristotle's ideas of that the Greeks were number one to manifest it into why the Puritans were number one and why it was okay for them to own black people as slaves too. So it's all this like plagiarism from this idea that went all the way back to when was Zurara? What was it, like the 1500s?
I have maybe 1415, only because that's on the same page as that says Prince Henry somewhere. So maybe 1500s.
Yeah. So I would say like mid to late mm-hmm. 1400s probably, because it seems like, because by page 7, he's saying Zurara was the first person to write about and defend black human ownership. And this single document began the recorded history of anti-black racist ideas.
Yeah. So if we're going all the way back to that, I mean, and then it goes on to say that Zura-Ra depicted Africans as savage animals that needed taming, which then if once you go on to read the book, we're going all the way to like the Nixon era where they're talking about when they were talking about how they were claiming black men as like predators, the ultimate predators. It's all tied in. And I think when I looked at it that way, like the racist ideals that the world has been built on, not just America, it's the racist ideals that the whole world has been built on, all kind of comes full circle.
Yeah.
I remember just saying that, like, instead of like with the whole slavery thing with Prince Henry, is that it was seen as like missionary work. Mm-hmm. And that was like the big thing is like, you know, they got money out of it, but at the same time, it's like, we're doing missionary work for enslaving like actual people. Like, and I think he compared it at one point. He was like, it's like owning a pair of sneakers. Like, it's just like crazy to think that, you know, that's where it all began, you know, that it was like, you know, based around missionary work.
Yeah. He makes it just seem like it was so easy. Like, Zura-Ra was like, oh yeah, Africans are savages and we need to tame them. And everybody was like, okay, sure, this sounds good. Because it wasn't them, you know? And a theme that I talk about all throughout my classes is literally everything is decided by ego and power and money. It always comes down to money. And it seems like even back then, it was just about power. How am I going to keep my power? I will enslave people. I will do these most disgusting things as long as it's not me. And as long as I'm in power and as long as I'm the one making the judgments and it doesn't matter who I hurt. And that's today as well. As long as, well, it's you or me kind of thing, you know, and people, who knows if it's out of fear or out of, you know, who else, who the heck knows that they just do things for money. And that's how the world is driven. And it kind of seems like a lot of things haven't changed. And that's, you know, the whole point of his book is they have to, you know?
And when we're teaching about Prince Henry, it's not like they mention any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, he was the great navigator and he did great things. Like, they don't talk about like this little side thing. Yep. It's like, yo, but he started slavery, like, you know?
Yeah.
And then that starts the cycle of our history being completely whitewashed because you're not talking about the horrible things that he did.
And I wonder where, because, I mean, if you think about what history you were learning in like elementary school. And, you know, and there's that fine line of, well, do you really want to talk about these horrid, gruesome things with little kids? You know what I mean? But you don't want to wait for them to get to high school to learn that all of these terrible things happened. Like my parents, I don't know if this is like going, you know, side note, they were asking questions about Columbus and they're like, well, why are people so mad? And my parents literally, you know, were, you know, educating and like, you know, researching things. And they're like, wow, I really didn't know all of these horrid things that were done. You know what I mean? And you don't want them to get old and not know these things. But then again, it's like, how do you, I don't know, how do you talk about these awful, atrocious things to like 6-year-olds, you know? And there just has to be a meaning, you know, there has to be a way to introduce it.
But I think that's what like in recent like posts on social media or discussions, a lot of the conversation is behind how like that exact thing, Jen, like how do you have these conversations with elementary schoolers instead of waiting until they get to middle or high school. So I think it's even like looking at children's books. Like I follow this one account, Diverse Spines, I think it is. And she is always posting about different diverse texts, like not just black people, but like Muslim and Asian and disabilities. So I think like having discussions in that way and saying like, yeah, you know, although we have Columbus Day maybe wasn't always the nicest person, and breaking it down like in a more general sense so then they're hearing it. But when they get to high school or even middle school, you can start getting a little more in depth. So it's always built upon. So it's not till high school when they are getting a fuller picture.
And I think like my knowledge has kind of evolved literally in the past couple months. Well, maybe in the past, you know, year or so with my own kids being in school, it's like I and maybe this is my own white privilege. You know, I never thought that this was a discussion that I would have to have. And that's a realization that I'm having, that I want my, you know, children's morals and thoughts to come from me. I don't. And they are actually being exposed even at the young age of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. They are being exposed to negative things. And I want them to be able to know from me that this is what is right and this is what is wrong. And, you know, we've started to have conversations that at this age, they're very open, which is another thing I've realized. They're very open to like learning and talking about things, and they want to, you know, they're like little sponges, as everybody says. So if you start just basically, you know, hey, you know, people are different races, people all look different, just like little things like that, I really do think that will help, you know, and so then as they grow up, they understand by the time they get to high school, this is just the norm. Everybody looks different. Everybody's different, you know, and that's, and I always make it seem like if everybody was the same, that would be boring. That's kind of the theme that we've been going with.
So from Zurara, right, then we go into the Puritans, which is where it got interesting for me because I teach Puritans when I read The Crucible. And I always teach, when I was reading this, I was like, okay, I'm glad I teach it the way I do because I do teach the students that the Puritans were actually psychopaths. And we talk about that. And I'm going to be able to use Stamp Now as a really great secondary source opposed to me pulling different articles. Now I have this that really breaks it down. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting when I always teach The Crucible and teach the Puritans is a lot of my students really have that mentality that you're taught in elementary school, that the Native Americans and the Puritans got along and they had a Thanksgiving and they all loved each other. And then I have to come in and be like, whoa, God, that's not how it is. That is not what happened. Like the Native Americans were viewed as savages and the Puritans were so afraid of stepping foot into the woods because they didn't want to get like an axe at their head because they literally took over their land. And the kids are always like, oh. But it's again, it starts with that idea of here comes the European white man that automatically assumed that they were allowed to overtake this land because they had this idea that because of the color of their skin was lighter, that they could do that. The crazy part when it starts about like the climate theory in chapter two.
The curse theory like blew my mind up. Like, I haven't even heard of that. Like, that's wild.
Right, yes.
And as Alexis reads the climate theory, I highlighted so many things. I have a giant question mark next to this paragraph. Like, my mind was literally blown that these are words that were written and believed.
So the climate theory, as written by Jason Reynolds, is this actually came from Aristotle. We'll get back to him later, who questioned whether Africans were born this way or if the heat of the continent made them inferior. Many agreed it was climate and that if African people lived in cooler temperatures, they could in fact become white.
And that is what they're stemming off of, the idea that Zurara was saying that the Africans were hypersexualized savages. And then he's saying, well, it's because that they were in this, you know, warmer climate. If we put them in a cooler temperature, don't worry, it'll be fine. They'll become white and they won't be hypersexualized savages anymore, guys. I've got it all.
And people were just like, okay.
But then, like, my thought is like, if that's your thought, then why are you treating them as less than if all you have to do is put them in another climate and they become like you? Right. Like, it's just crazy. And then it clearly didn't work. So they just had to, and I guess that's like the rest of the book, is they had to keep coming up with different theories and ideas to justify it. Mm-hmm. Because, like, obviously when someone from Africa lives in a cooler climate, they don't become white.
Well, he writes right before he says that, where you were saying, you know, why? It says, because if there's one thing we all know about humans, it's that most of us are followers looking for something to be part of to make us feel better about our own selfishness. Mm. So they were drinking the Kool-Aid because they were trying to somehow justify in their hearts why this was okay.
Right.
Because you don't want to be the only one that disagrees. You don't want to be the only kid in the class when the teacher makes a point and she's like, oh, does everybody agree? And you're like, you don't want to be the only one. So people are just like, okay.
And then we go on to curse theory.
Yeah. So in 1577, we had a guy named George Best. He's an English traveler, show up in Canada and meets him, some of the natives. And he decided that since they had darker skin, that they were cursed. So that was like the part of the curse theory. And where did his reference come from? It came from the Bible. And the story that's within it says, Noah orders his white sons not to have sex with their wives on the ark. And then tells them that if their first child born after the flood would inherit the earth. When the evil, tyrannical, and hypersexual Ham, goes Ham, has sex on the ark, God wills that Ham's descendants will be dark and disgusting, and the whole world will look at them as symbols of trouble. So, and it says simply put, Ham's kids would be black and bad, ultimately making black bad. Curse theory would become the anchor of what would justify American slavery.
And the black man, they say that in the Crucible over and over again. And it me and whenever we're acting the play out, the kids are always like, oh my God, why do they keep saying the black man?
Yeah.
And I have to tell them, because that's literally what they were saying was the curse of this town. They were associating the black man with the curse, the evil, the devil. Those two were going hand in hand.
And we see it like throughout like the rest of time, like, you know, it's still perceived like, you know, if something's dark or if it's black, it's bad. And then you see it even later on, like if it's white, it's like the savior, like that's the hero. They wear white, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Black magic,
right.
White magic.
Oh, that's the part that's crazy. Like even you just sit here, like my mind still is like, how much a society is built upon these racist ideas and justifications for like putting down an entire race of people.
Yeah, that they unjustly brought here though, or not brought, stole to.
Right.
Stole. Like, and it's just all kind of crazy to me when I really start to sit there and just think about it. I'm just like, what is the, you know, the Puritans leave England because they're sick of their way of life over there. So they say, we don't like being persecuted. We don't like the way that like England is treating us. And they come to America for this better way of life, only to make this better way of life worse for anyone that wasn't them.
Right.
So it's just so hypocritical. And is everything that racism lies on is one big hypocritical notion.
Speaking of hypocritical, I wrote this down because like as I was reading, this was only on page 19, so I hadn't really gotten really into the book. But I wrote why. You know, still trying to understand the why. Why were Africans chosen? You know what I mean? Because I wrote down, well, maybe because they look different, they dress different, but people in Europe all dress different and look different. And I guess they did have wars with each other, you know, because they dress different and look different. And it's, and that's kind of like, well, why did no one stand up and say, no, you know, this would have all been avoided. Could you imagine?
Yeah. It is though. Why? Like, why did they choose Africa to just completely take?
But they did the same thing to the Native Americans. So it's like anyone that they seem as like, less than. So like Europe had all of these wars and was, you know, further ahead technology wise. And they look at Africans and Native Americans who are fighting with axes and bow and arrow, and the Europeans are showing up with guns, that they think, oh, I'm like here to help these people. And they clearly are behind or not the chosen ones, because look at the way their way of life, when we know now, you know, that's not the case. But so much of that justification that they have is that they are trying to help them. So I think they see, oh, we're like further advanced. If you're comparing, they think they're further advanced, but really they're just living a different, completely different way of life. You know, Africa's huge and they're doing their thing in Africa, and Europeans are fighting each other.
And that comes back to ego. I feel like I'm the best, you know, and that's another theme that we teach is that America, we just always thought we were the best. We're the best at everything. And then that comes from Europe. Europe thought that we're the best. So everyone should be like us because we're the best. And that's the theme that they thought, not, oh, wow, these people are different. We can learn from them. They can learn from us, kind of thing.
I saw this YouTube video the other day and it was called The Origins of Race. And it was maybe like 10 minutes long. So I would really recommend everybody watch it. And it talks about this woman, she's a historian, and she explains like how race began. And she talks about like Christopher Columbus coming over and like how they didn't understand each other. So they were like judging really just like each other. And again, like Europeans wanting again to be better than and justify, oh, but we're trying to help you, but really they're not helping anyone. You're literally taking people away from their homes and their land, which
they
is why
they wanted everything to fit their mold. Right. Anything that wasn't their mold wasn't right.
Yeah, no forced assimilation.
Right. Yeah.
which is why I think the curriculums, like, not even just at Overbrook, but in general, like, in world history, when I was taking world history, I remember really only learning about the colonization of Africa. You never learn about Africa before colonization, and it's written down. There's history on it. There's tribes and different people and princes and kings. Like, there were real people. They weren't standing there waiting to be taken and saved. They had an entire way of life. So I think that's also where we can sometimes currently be doing our students a injustice, is because they don't learn about that. They only learn, oh, Africa became Africa and was a player in the world stage because Europeans went over and helped them. And like they stole them, but like they helped them too, you know?
World history is like essentially like European history for most of that time that we teach right now. And, you know, I talk about all, like, every single one of those countries more than I talk about two gigantic continents. We talk about Latin America for maybe 2 weeks, I think, or 3 weeks. And then Africa, like you said, like, it's like about the colonization, and that's really it. That's all we're talking about.
That's why I love your, when it's Black History Month, your door that you did this year, Alexis, with, we didn't steal slaves. Oh, we stole doctors. We stole teachers. We stole, like, that's so, they were living their life. Like, and then Europeans came and said, no, but it's not the way that you should be living. So we're going to take you to this desolate land that is totally bare and needs to be built from the ground up. Will you do that for us?
But I think that that's also when sometimes, like, I'll have discussions with students and they say, like, they're not American or whatever. And I heard it in the 1619 podcast as well from the New York Times. In the first episode, the host is talking about how she doesn't understand why her dad always takes pride in the American flag. Like, their house can be tattered and paint's wearing off and, like, their yard looks a mess, but he always would put out a new flag, and she is Black. And she says that she talks to him and she's like, well, my ancestors built this country as much as the white person across the street. So he's like, I have to take pride in this country that my ancestors built. And the episode later goes on to talk about, like, Abraham Lincoln is known as this great emancipator, but how he pulled free Black people into the White House. Like, he picked, like, five Black men and said, like, look, we'll help you free your people, but then, like, you can't stay here. Like, there's no way we can live together. You guys, like, I have money from Congress. We'll send you wherever you want to go. And they all said, all five of them said no, because they're like, this is the land that my grandfather built. This is my parents, my ancestors died to build this country. So it's as much my country as it is yours. And I think that sometimes that can be lost on the younger generation.
Yeah.
Because I don't think about it that way. I really hadn't. I had only thought about it until I heard that podcast from the New York Times and did some other, like, research on it. And so I just thought that was an interesting viewpoint.
I was, like, listening. I think it was from This American Life podcast that I was listening to. And it was saying how, yes, there weren't slaves in the North. So we always think, like, oh, the North was doing this great thing because they didn't believe in slavery. But at the same time, like, African Americans were having to do all of this free labor, like, to give into, like, the textiles, building the North still. And we don't really talk about that. Like, yeah, we weren't owning slaves, and I'm putting that in quotes, but they were still doing all of this basically free labor to build this country still at that time.
Right.
So, and I never learned that. I just always thought, yeah, well, from the North, we never thought about slavery, but, like, we...
It's just a different form. Like, you're not having them out in the fields and whipping them all the, like, exactly. I'm sure out in the fields of Pennsylvania, you're telling me they didn't have a couple of slaves working those fields somewhere, or even in New Jersey. So I think, you know, the free labor of working in an industry or for a trade, still slavery, is just a different form of it. So I would, yeah.
Well,
it's crazy.
We do our abolitionist unit, or I do the abolitionist unit. And like, a lot of the kids kind of have that notion that, oh, they were from the North. They're these great people. And I always try and tell them, don't give these people more credit than they actually deserve. And I said, you know, when we talk about John Brown and, you know, wanting to free slaves, I said, very, very few people were like him. Very few, you know, and like, a lot of people maybe thought about slavery, like, okay, I want to free slaves, but I don't want everybody to be equal. you know, because it all goes back to money and ego. And I don't want somebody to be just like me, and I don't want somebody to make the same amount of money as me. And, you know, I try and I'll do that probably even more now with this book.
So I guess we go from, you know, now we're in the 1600s, right? And America's being built, and they're talking about how tobacco is the number one resource, and they have to have the slaves like doing the work, right? So that way America can be built. And no one cares really, because they're using all of these harsh words, basically this propaganda against African Americans. So that way no one's really fighting for their equality. They're using words again like barbaric, savages, Africans couldn't be loved. Even by God, they couldn't be loved, because that's what they were being told to believe, that this, like John was saying, this was a missionary at work, and they were doing God's work by using these slaves. So they're being fed these beliefs, and people aren't fighting against it. So then that brings us to the time. So now we're at the time where it's Native Americans and the Puritans, and they've got like a beef going on, quote unquote, as Jason Reynolds says. And there is a white laborer, Nathaniel Bacon, who kind of sees the injustice between poor whites and the white elites. So he decides that, you know, it would be a great idea if he can get the whites and the blacks to join forces against these white elites. And of course, the governor at the time is like, absolutely not. That cannot happen, because if the poor whites and the blacks join forces, you know, they're going to be a party that cannot be reckoned with. So due to that, he creates white privilege. So Jason Reynolds writes, time for a breath break. Everyone inhale it, hold it, exhale, and breathe it out. Privilege. Still here? Good. Let's move on. So white privileges were created, and at this time they included, 1, only the white rebels were pardoned. Legislators prescribed 30 lashes for any slave who lifted a hand against any Christian. Christian now meant white. 2, all whites now wielded absolute power to abuse any African person. Those are the two most important ones. Poor whites wouldn't be punished, but they could surely do the punishing.
Because, again, in the 1619 podcast, they talked about this idea of why was it poor whites did not relate more or help more with slaves, because they had more in common with slaves than they did with their white elite and white counterparts, the plantation owners. And they were talking about how elite and the upper class gave them more privileges, and like being allowed to vote, although you didn't own land, because it used to be only a white landowner. Well, then it was, you had to be a white male. It didn't matter if you owned land. So then by giving them that sense of equality, then they thought they had one up on the slaves. Well, I can vote and I'm better than you. And so again, giving that white privilege.
Why am I not going to take this? And it's like, well, it's because it's wrong. You know, but right, I right. realized that back then, it's just kind of like, well, I'm looking out for myself before I'm looking out for everybody.
And that's what they wanted. So many of them wanted to be these big plantation owners, and they couldn't, because, you know, it was hard for them to work their way up to owning that much land. So they took whatever power they could in order to feel like justified in their race and their whiteness, you know?
On this page, I just love that he breaks it up. Like, and he does this throughout the book. Like, I like that he like takes it and puts some space, and like this way you can see more into it. Like, hey, like this is a big part. Like, look at this big gap. Like, I'm writing this in big letters and writing numbers next to it, because you should probably pay attention here instead of just having it all jumbled in like part of a paragraph, because then it can get lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I like how it's like, time for a breath break. Everyone inhale, hold it, exhale, and breathe it out.
Right.
Privilege. Like, because I think he's having everyone process this idea of white privilege, because especially now, I mean, what a time for this book to come out. It just came out in March. So I think for white people, a lot of people have said that that word of privilege is hard for them to swallow and fully process and understand. So when he has everyone, you know, who's reading it, exhale, breathe it out, privilege, you know, they're really breaking that down.
Because for a lot of people, that term white privilege, they're thinking is a new term, but here he is saying like, no, this is dating all the way back to the 1600s. Like, the idea of white privilege isn't so new at all. So then he goes on to talk about the Salem witch hunts, how that kind of all stemmed too from this racist ideal, because these white girls supposedly, which turns out to be the biggest sham, I think, in American history, were being possessed. And they turn it around to say that the devil, who we already noted was the quote unquote black man, dark figure, was the one possessing these girls, when really we find out that these girls were just liars. But because of this, essentially the witch hunt, now it's another reason why they're looking at the black man as dangerous, because supposedly they are witches that are taking over these little white girls and everyone feels scared. So then he goes on to say, you know, after the witch hunts died down, on page 33, he says, as the population of enslaved people grew, which is what slaveholders needed in order to till the land and grow the tobacco for free, the fear of more revolt grew with it. And because of that, slaveholders and politicians created a new unnatural system, so a new set of racist codes. And these codes, we don't see, like, no interracial relationships. That code wasn't broken until 1960s. That went on for years and years and years. So this was instilled from the very beginning. Again, so the first rule was no interracial relationships. The second rule says tax imported captives. 3, classify natives and blacks the same way you would horses and hogs in the tax code, meaning they were literally classified as livestock and not as human. That is, I have chills when I just read that. Like, that is so disgusting.
And that's like throughout the whole entire time, people were just always like, I mean, you've already said that, what, 4 times? Like, okay, like everyone just like rolled with it every single time. Like, no one's questioning anything. Because at the end of the day, but who does it work out for? It works out for them. So why wouldn't they shake their head? You know what I mean?
So even though, and then at the end of that chapter, it says, even though Cotton Mather's dies, like it's his ideals, the beliefs, these rules he put out, they don't die with him just because his body's gone. Well, his ideals still live on for years and years to come. Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about the John Locke thing where he actually said that the white brain is the purest one. So anyone other than that is bad. And a lot of our ideas that, you know, that Thomas Jefferson stole is from John Locke. So it's like, man, he really wanted to be like John Locke. You know what I mean? So I just wanted to throw that out there. Jen actually read this before me, my fiance Jen. And she was like, that was the first thing she told me as she was reading. She like stopped. She's like, did you know how like messed up this part was? Did you know it wasn't just about taxes? And she's like, did you know that your man Jefferson? And I was like, my man Jefferson? I was like, you know how like crazy he was? And I was like, no, but can I have the book now?
But I think that's what's like really just so crazy. And you know, we've been living in a tough couple of months, and I follow a lot of different people and new people. And it's this post about, you know, black people not wanting to celebrate the 4th of July because of some of those ideals behind this American independence.
It starts with Jefferson on page 55. And it kind of starts with him, and he's 33 years old. He is at the Second Continental Congress and basically comes up with the Declaration. And of course, in the Declaration, he writes that all men are created equal. And then the reading goes on to say, but were slaves seen as men? And what about women? And what did this mean for Jefferson, a man who owned nearly 200 slaves, was writing America's freedom document? So he's kind of this contradiction is a word that they use to describe him a lot, which is quite accurate and probably accurate for a lot of people at that time. It all goes back to, you know, economics versus morals, you know, money versus morals. Which one are you going to choose?
Yeah, he says it's on page 42 where he does this in like a really funny way. I was like laughing when I read this part, but he says about Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson might have been the world's first white person to say, I have black friends. I don't know if that's true, but I'm willing to make the bet. He was raised non-religious in a house where Native Americans were house guests and black people, those slaves, were his friends, as far as he could tell. As a young man, he didn't think of them as less or considered slavery much at all. As a matter of fact, Jefferson didn't even really see them as slaves. It wasn't until he was older, when his African friends started telling him about the horrors of slavery, including the terror in his own home. So he he was saying like, oh, I don't look at them as slaves, but like there's these horrible things that are literally happening in my backyard to them from my family members. But they're my friends. It's fine. So that in itself was one giant contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he kept calling them friends. And then he says, I don't know about you all, but I don't own my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His dad owned like the second largest like number of the county. And then it went on to say that he studied anti-racist thought, even though he was a slave owner. It's like, how contradictory could you be?
Then it goes on to say slavery wasn't about people. It was about profit. Mm-hmm. And like so many Americans at the time, he chose to overlook the horrific things that were being done to slaves and chose profit and money over people. Yeah.
And then apparently, so it says in the Declaration, he also wrote into the Declaration the anti-racist sentiment that slavery was a cruel war against human nature, but that part and other parts like it were edited out by other more established delegates. So he's so contradictory. You know, he wanted to put that in the Declaration, but then he's still owning slaves. You know, he knows that it's cruel and against human nature, but I'm still going to do it. Apparently, I didn't know he wrote this book. It's called Notes on the State of Virginia. And says in it, he expressed, and this is what I like about the author is, you know, he's putting his own thoughts into it. He says, in it, he expressed his real thoughts on Black people. Uh-oh. He said they could never assimilate because they were inferior by nature. Uh-oh. Said they felt love more, but pain less. Uh-oh. That they aren't reflective and operate only on instinct. Yikes. That the freedom of slaves would result in the extermination of one of the races, i.e. a race war. Uh-oh. And the answer to the problem of slaves was that they should be sent back to Africa. That's another thing that the book talks about is this idea of kind of like reverse colonization almost, you know, sending Africans back to Africa. And then it mentions, you know, Jefferson purchased the Louisiana area once he was president, or sending them to Louisiana, you know, just kind of like ostracizing an entire race. To be like, okay, well, we took you from your homeland and enslaved you and raped you and murdered you and, you know, destroyed your soul. So we're going to give you this little piece of land for you and your family to live on.
Yeah. And then on top of it, that Thomas Jefferson goes on to have a relationship with a slave and has six children from a slave like that. And there's this idea of, well, you know, maybe it was a mutual relationship, but in any way you look at it, there is hierarchy. He is her master at the time. It doesn't matter if it was mutual. It's still an abuse of power. And we don't know if it was mutual. I mean, and that's something I never learned that in history class. I learned that on my own.
I feel like it's like there's no way it was mutual because, you know, even if you're saying it is, like she's seeing it as an opportunity to get ahead of the rest of probably the slave to be able to like get away with things and not have to do certain things and everything like that. So again, like, it wasn't in my mind.
Yeah, and it goes back to you didn't love her. You don't own people that you love. And she's another, Sally Hemings, she's another person that I want to focus on, you know, this coming year, because the book also talks about how women aren't really talked about in race. It's kind of like Black men are really focused on more than Black women. So that's another thing that I would kind of like to, you know, focus on her and her life and see what kind of information there is about, you know, her thoughts and beliefs and all kinds of things with her and Jefferson.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. Like, I would have been way more invested in history class if we were learning about, if I was learning things like that, something I'd never learned before. Were there letters? Was there any sort of communication between them back and forth? Like, is there any documentation about it? Like, so, and there was recently, I saw a picture of Thomas Jefferson's like great, 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 great grandchild redid his picture next to Thomas Jefferson. And he's very clearly African-American, but he's a descendant of Thomas Jefferson. It was just so cool to see the recreation done of it.
It's interesting that you say you would have been more invested in history class, because I kind of even make the joke in class, like when we're starting a new unit and the kids are like, oh, what are we talking about now? And I'm like, more old white men. You know, it's like I make the joke and, you know, and I you just have to expand more on, you know, women and different cultures and what's happening with slaves at the time. What are their thoughts? What are their feelings? There's definitely, you know, so many things out there that the kids in your class can relate to more if you talk about, like, Sally Hemings, you know, what she was going through and her thoughts and her, you know, maybe she has a diary somewhere that you can read.
So to segue, slaves start to become free, right? They're being emancipated. Abraham Lincoln, right, exactly, supposedly frees the slaves. Really, though, you know, we talk about this idea of you guys don't really go into the idea of Reconstruction and how they're kind of left to just fend for themselves almost. You know, they've had no idea of what life outside of being slaves was. And now they're being freed, but they still have this stigma on them that they're these savage, hypersexualized, scary beasts. So now they're in this country that's like, hey, go off, you're free, go do your thing. And they don't, there's still not that ability to do that because there's all of these underlying factors behind that.
Chapter 13 is where they talk about Abe and how it's like, how even he was like an assimilationist, and we see him as like this guy who did a lot, but he really was just doing it for himself and all that type of stuff. And really the only reason he wanted to end slavery was for poor white people to get ahead.
And even he mentioned like Liberia, like sending people to Liberia. I read that wasn't in this book. That was in a different book that I read. So he's, you know, very complicated in his beliefs. The line that says in the beginning of chapter 14, it says, as quickly as things are done, they are also undone. So you kind of have, you know, the end of the Civil War with all of these high hopes and, you know, the 13th Amendment and all of these things. And, you know, William Lloyd Garrison with his Liberator newspaper, you know, the feeling of hope kind of dies with Lincoln, because even if he had these hopes of laws and things that he wanted to do, here comes Andrew Johnson, who is really the only reason Andrew Johnson, why they wanted him to run with him, is because Andrew Johnson was not very similar to Abraham Lincoln. So they thought that they would get a couple more votes if they had Andrew Johnson in as the vice president. And Andrew Johnson was, you know, in full support of black restrictions. Under his presidency, you have the KKK that is formed with no recourse. There's no laws against them. It's just like, okay, like kind of back to that mentality of, oh, okay, here comes the KKK, welcome to the party. And Johnson does nothing about it.
Right. And that's like on top of, like I was talking about in the last podcast, was that documentary 13th on Netflix, and how they say the 13th Amendment came out, but in there it said that anyone who's in jail can be used pretty much as a slave. So you see a lot of African Americans getting arrested for something as small as loitering, just so they can still be used to do whatever, you know, people who have those textiles or, you know, have those plantation can still use them to their advantage.
It mentions Thaddeus Stevens as well, who was a big proponent in passing the 13th Amendment. And he came up with this idea of redistributing land to newly freed African Americans. People's rebuttal to that was, well, how will they know how to take care of the land if it's just given to them?
What?
Like, they've been tending the land this whole time. What are you talking about?
They know more than
how
anyone.
Are you going to take care of your land?
Yeah. If I do it way better.
just no backing to anyone's arguments. But again, nobody was saying anything out. If they were saying things out loud, you see Abraham Lincoln's work just being completely reversed, and then you get that loss of hope again. So it's like, we've done all of these steps and we're working hard, and we see that now. I mean, I feel that now sometimes. It's like George Floyd, we're seeing all of these people finally recognizing injustices, but then I go online and I see another cop kneeling on somebody's neck in Pennsylvania. Yeah. And it's like, well, now I feel the loss of hope.
Yeah, that's it, the loss of hope. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, what's the point? I'm trying. Yeah. And, you know, we have, like, William Lloyd Garrison was, like, giving up because Andrew Johnson's president. And he's like, what am I going to do? Andrew Johnson is a huge, big racist. What am I going to do?
Yeah. Seems like it's not really treading water on this type of thing.
For the KKK, that, again, it's still established today, is still running in this country, as much as people want to say no, and they want to turn a blind eye to it, that is still a fully established program that people fully commit to. And it's scary, but we had a president that was, or a vice president that was completely like, yes, you know what, I agree, let's do that. Let's bar blacks from voting. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure that they don't have any sort of rights. Let's do social codes that then become Jim Crow laws, like that we saw for years and years and years, and we're still seeing effects of today.
And that's why Lincoln died, was because he made a speech about giving black men the right to vote. And John Wilkes Booth watched that speech be given outside of the, I think it was the White House. And he said, that's it. That's it. Like, that threatened white men so much, was allowing black men the right to vote, that he shot him for it, hoping that it would end. And it did. That thought died with him for at least a couple years. You know, it gave people like John Wilkes Booth a couple more years to be in power.
Yeah.
That's the running theme through the book, is how people time and time from 1400s to 2020 continue to justify the racial inequality. It's because people in power will always find a way to justify the behavior or find some type of loophole.
Yeah.
Where the Jack Johnson versus Tarzan part starts, and I just think that that's interesting, like something that I never would have thought of before.
Absolutely not.
And that's another, like, you don't even hear about Jack Johnson. Like, I didn't know.
No, I thought the singer
in general, like, until I read this book, and he's supposedly like one of the greatest to ever do it. And like, how is he not mentioned more throughout history, like sports history? You know,
boxing was really, I guess, a large sport. It still is. No, but
it was,
I guess,
way bigger back then. It was like the best. Like, it was like top notch back in the day. Yeah.
It's talking about, I guess, this match. They're kind of cleverly comparing it to Du Bois and Washington, but then they say that fight was nothing like the actual fight that was going on in the ring. And it says black people used black fighters as a way to symbolically beat on white America's racism. White people used white fighters to prove superiority over black people in the ring and therefore in the world. No boxer broke the backs of white people and puffed up the chests of black people like Jack Johnson.
Right. And this is in that early, like, this is like, it says like 1908, and he finally gets a shot at it with Tommy Burns, who he beats the brakes off of.
And, you know, in this really racist society, here is this black boxer beating the brakes off of a white man. So what are these white racists going to think? Oh, no, no, that can't happen.
And I underlined where they said the reason black people were good wasn't because of practice and hard work, but because they were born with it. Note, black assimilationists have also made this argument, which is racist. It gave white people a way to explain away their own failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like completely disregard any skill, hard work, and dedication I put into this sport, and just simply say, I was born with this. Right. Like, you're that, what?
Insane.
It was also, because back then, of course, there's, you know, laws, the way that you're allowed to speak to white people. And Johnson would, as boxers and fighters do today, they kind of, you know, talk trash on each other. And that's like a big thing, like in MMA, right? Don't they like get up there and they pretend to fight before they fight, whatever. It says, so if Johnson arrived on the scene dressed in fancy clothes, hands adorned with diamonds, all black people were psychologically dressed to the nines, at least for a while. If Johnson talked slick to white men, saying whatever he wanted, all black people got away with it, got away with a verbal jab or two. So it kind of, you know, made them feel good, because you weren't, literally, by law, were not allowed to speak to white people in a certain way. You could get thrown in jail.
Right. And on top of that, and this is what I found interesting, he was dating... he was married to a white woman, which back then, like, white people hated that, you know? So that pushed them even more to really hate this guy and try to get a retired boxer to beat the best in the world. Like,
right. Yeah. So then, yeah, they say immediately white people started to cry out for a great white hope to beat Johnson. That hope was a retired heavyweight champion, James J. Jeffrey. So no one right now can currently beat him, guys. So we've got to pull in the big guns, a retired boxer to come in.
Right, and why does there have to be a great white hope? Why can't, you know what I mean? Like, that's what you can always think of. It's like, why can't we just be happy that we're watching one of the best to ever do it?
Exactly. Why can't you appreciate the
white guy to be like, beat him up? You know, it's like, you know, just shows you the time, how crazy it was. It
goes towards like how we were just talking about the hurdles, and they said, so they figured out a way to get rid of Jack Johnson, and I wrote, literally in my margin, I wrote, oh, always knocked down.
Yep. Yeah. So he had way too much power for white people to appreciate. So they knocked him down. It says they figured out a way to get rid of Johnson to stop him. They arrested him on trumped up charges for trafficking a prostitute, or rather a white woman, across state lines. He ran, spent 7 years out of the country before turning himself in and doing a year in jail.
Right. He missed out on 8 years of being the best. Yep. Because he had to run away for something that wasn't true.
It still wasn't enough to make white men feel good about themselves. So a man named Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote a book to reinforce the idea of white supremacy and to remind white men that Africans, black people, were savages. It was called Tarzan of the Apes.
This blew my
mind.
Yeah, so like literally take a second, think of Tarzan that you guys grew up with, the whatever it was that you watched, if it was the cartoon or the version of it. But then it says, you know, this version, here's the basic plot of the book series. One, a white child named John Clayton is orphaned in Central Africa. Two, John is raised by apes. Three, they change his name to Tarzan, which means white skin. Four, Tarzan becomes the best hunter and warrior, better than all the Africans. Five, eventually, he teaches himself to read. Six, in the sequels and subsequent stories, Tarzan protects a white woman named Jane from being ravished by Africans. Seven, Tarzan protects a white woman named Jane from being ravished by Africans. Eight, Tarzan protects a white woman named Jane from being ravished by Africans. So that plot, when you think about it, you're like, oh my God.
You would have never known.
They literally call it a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
So it's just the control over the entertainment, and whether it's real entertainment, like sports, you know, with boxing, or movie entertainment. And then it goes into Birth of a Nation. Yeah. Which was literally shown at the White House. Like, at the White House.
And Wilson. Then the necessity of constantly having to make the white man feel good. Mm-hmm. And having to make the white man feel comfortable. And that is something that we've brought up in this podcast multiple times. Whether it was Mr. Fisher or Alexis, I think you said it. Having to shrink yourself or keep yourself quieter to make someone else feel comfortable. And that someone else is usually somebody that is white. So again, these ideas from, yeah, it seems silly from Tarzan or from the Jack Johnson boxer, but they're still very relevant and transferable today.
We jump from Tarzan to then seeing our president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, decide that the best film to show in the White House for the first time is called The Birth of the Nation, which is based off a book called The Klansman. And I mean, this is the basic plot. You know, a black man played by a white man in blackface tries to rape a white woman. And they showed, I've seen clips of it, and it's pretty much this guy, and he looks like an animal. They try to portray him as though. She jumps off a cliff and kills herself before that can happen. Then you have the KKK, and you have Klansmen who avenge her death by killing the black man. The end. Like, that's what we want to show in the White House for the first time. So if you want to get a gist of what Woodrow Wilson really thought, you know, that sums it up in a nutshell. I also heard Woodrow Wilson's wife was like even more racist than like Woodrow Wilson. Like, I heard she was like pushing for segregation, like wouldn't even talk to like African Americans, like all that stuff. I heard like he pushed for it more than he even did.
There's a lot of like theories, or I don't even know if they're theories, but that a lot of slaveholders, their wives were actually way more abusive and racist towards the slaves than the men were. It's easy when I read this book, it was not easy to see, but it was more understandable to see why generations before us, or why my mom's mom was growing up in an era where these racist beliefs were just the norm. Or when was Richard Nixon president? Like, what years was that?
70s.
That is the 70s. Like, my mom was like 8, 9, 10. Like, in the 70s, she was a teenager. So for people like Frankie's parents, this is what they were being immersed in. Right. Richard Nixon's the president spewing these ideals. Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon and his team looked at the way George Wallace had run for his campaign, Vote for Hate, and felt like it was a good idea to follow in his footsteps. Nixon believed the segregationist approach was a good one because it would lock down all the true blue segregationists. You know, he was looking to get the white vote, and whatever he was going to do to get it, he was going to do. So that was white people who were afraid of everything black, black neighborhoods, black schools, black people, and the brilliant game plan Nixon used to drive an even bigger wedge and get racists on his side was to simply demean black people in every speech while also praising white people. So here I'm going to tell you why the black person's bad, and I'm going to tell you white people why you're great. And it's going to get the vote. And it works. And then it says, you know, that's kind of where it goes back to things like the word ghetto stemmed from his speeches mm-hmm. that he was delivering to American citizens in the 1970s. And people were like, rah, rah, yes, this is great.
I know it's funny, undesirables are still used today. Like, I think like, you know, when they're building something in like a nicer neighborhood, they don't want that built there because they say that's going to bring in undesirables. So it's like, well, you're going to tell me that a Wawa being built is going to bring in undesirables? Oh, yeah, that's where we get into Ronald Reagan. And
So we go from Richard Nixon to then we go on to Ronald Reagan, who was an actor. He first running for president, he loses, but then he says he comes back with a vengeance, does not give up in 1980. And then it says, a new shaky propaganda that many people took seriously about genetics coding us to be who we are, as if there were a gene for racism. New anti-racist feminist thought coming from writers like bell hooks and, of course, Angela Davis, but nothing could prepare anyone for what was coming. 2 years into Reagan's presidency, he issued one of the most devastating executive orders of the 20th century, the War on Drugs. Its role, maximum punishment for drugs like marijuana.
I found this like line, I highlighted this part, is like, only 2% of Americans view drugs as America's most pressing problem. But that was like what his whole campaign bought into it. They were like, man, maybe he's right. It's like only 2% was worried about it, but you all were just like, you know what? You're wrong for not voting for that. Like, it is a big problem. Like, he just created a problem instead of, like, thinking of other things to deal with. And then I'll read, you know, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which came out, was this bill gave a minimum 5-year sentence for a drug dealer or drug user caught with 5 grams of crack, the amount typically handled by blacks and poor people, while mostly white and rich users and dealers of powder cocaine who operated in neighborhoods with fewer police had be caught with 500 grams to receive the same 5-year minimum sentence. So, I mean, like, they're different forms, but it's the same thing. So, like, how could you even justify putting that act together at that time?
Yeah. It literally says, let that sink in. Same drug, different form. One gets 5 years in prison if caught with 5 grams, the size of 2 quarters. The other gets a 5-year prison for 500 grams, the size of a brick. And it's because the one with the size of the 2 quarters is saying, well, black people are carrying that more, the crack, the rock, opposed to the cocaine that the white people are carrying, which would be a size of a brick to get the same sentencing. Mm-hmm. And that's what his campaign was running on.
But goes back to that 13th Amendment, that loophole to justify, like I literally wrote in my margin, the new Jim Crow. It's this idea of mass incarceration for that legal segregation of putting black people in prisons and jails, because prison and jails is also a business and they make so much money off of them. And white people don't have to go because they would have to be carrying a brick of cocaine.
Right. But like
that documentary 13th, Just Mercy, the book, The New Jim Crow, like it's just changing form. Nothing's changing. It's just the form of it is changing.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And I think that is what we need to realize is people that are arguing against, no, black people have it just the same. No, there isn't any such thing as white privilege. No, please do your research and read this book and you will realize that you're wrong. You're dead wrong. I mean, from that act in the 80s, then it goes on to talk about how they were putting more police in African American communities. So of course they were going to be getting caught with drugs because there was 10 times more police in these communities, you know, and then you go on to in New York City when they introduced that idea of freeze and pat, and they were just allowed to stop anyone of color and pat them down to see if they had drugs on them. Anyone, they could just do that to anyone. That was a law that was That was okay. That is not fair. So if you're still sitting here and arguing that, then I really can't. I don't have the breath for it. I just don't.
On the next page where he says, and the media as always drove the stereotypes without discussing the racist framework that created much of them. Once again, Black people were lazy and violent. The men were absent from the home because they were irresponsible and careless. And the Black family was withering due to all of this, but especially according to Reagan, because of welfare. And he goes on to say, the worst part is that everyone believed it, even Black people. And so I think when we talk about today, you have Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who wrote the fuller version, Sam from the Beginning, and that book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. In his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, he talks about how he believed some of these racist ideas and how he also had to learn how to be anti-racist. Because it's true, like, how many people really make jokes about Black people not having a dad? Like, oh, wow, your dad. Or like, of course I don't have a dad. Like, everyone is buying into these ideals and beliefs, as everyone's justifying it.
Or, you know, if white people didn't get that 400-year start, then we probably wouldn't even be talking about this.
But then, like, I found it so interesting when he went on to talk about the Cosby family, like the assimilationist show, and how, you know, they had to have both parents, and they were doctors, and they were so hardworking, like, you should be like the Huxtables. But for so many people, they were getting arrested on charges that weren't the same as their white counterparts. And if a Black family, Jason Reynolds writes, didn't operate like the Huxtables, they weren't worthy of respect.
Right. Why did everyone have to be a cookie cutter? Like, way, why does a family got to have this cookie cutter thing? And that's what you're trying to portray has to be the way each family has to function. Why couldn't it be a construction worker and like a teacher or like something else? Like, why does it have to be a doctor and what was it, a doctor and a lawyer, you said, right?
Also, I want to just say, if you haven't listened to Jason Reynolds reading this, like, you have to. It's actually phenomenal. Like, because you know how you were laughing about his voice when you were reading it, and it was like, uh-oh. Like, he really is, like, it sounds like he's talking to this book. Like, I listened to it, so it could also help me process. So I kept it on Audible so then I can play it for the kids as we're reading it, or pieces of it, because it's just so good.
So then, you know, rap artists, hip hop artists start to voice their opinions through their music, which then creates this stigma against rap and hip hop that they are aggressive and that they are, you know, against anti-American. It says by the end of 1993, rappers were under attack. They were being criticized from all sides, not just from Bill Clinton, you know, but from every single angle. It says 66-year-old civil rights veteran C. Dolores Tucker and her National Political Congress of Black Women took the media portrayals debate to a new racist level in their strong campaign to ban gangster rap. To her, rap music was setting Black people back. She felt like it was making Black people more violent, more materialistic, more sexual.
Well, that's the thing. In their music, they're trying to portray like exactly what they were going through on the daily, and not trying to like say, like, you know, not glorifying it. It's more like, this is what we have to do to survive, type thing. Like, and I don't think people understand that when they listen to it. It's like more like, this is cool, you should be doing this too. And that's not what they're going for at all. Like, what do you want me to talk about? You know what I mean? This is what I have to do every day. Like, what else do you want me to talk about?
But I think it's because people don't want to face that reality.
The year 1995 was when the term super predator was created by Princeton University scholar John Julio to describe Black 14 to 17 year olds. Murder rates were up among that age range, but so was unemployment.
So you're targeting teenagers, children, and calling them super predators. And that's okay. Nothing, super predator.
Because, and I think that's where, like, when Black families say that they have to have those discussions with their kids, is because, like, scholars, in quotes, are deeming them as super predators at the time that they're 14. So, you know, you're 14, you're probably in like 9th grade. And so from your whole starting the year you become a freshman in high school, you're deemed a super predator. So
right. Reminds me of why people's parents or people have these racist ideals in their mind, because this is what they're being told from, again, quote unquote scholars that are coining these terms, super predators, and saying there's science to back this up, when this book constantly keeps telling you there was no science to back it up. Just to end it, he says, and what I've learned is that you're far more open and empathetic than the generations before you, so much so that your sensitivity is used as an insult, a slight against you. Your desire for a fair world is seen as a weakness. What I've learned is that your anger is global because the world now sits in the palm of your hands. You have the ability to teleport, to scroll upon a war zone or a murder, to witness protests and revolution from cultures not your own, but who share your frustration, your refusal, your fear. So I always tell the students, you guys are my hope. You are the generation that's going to fix it. You have to be. And I really do believe that. I really do think that a change is coming and we cannot lose hope. And I know I too feel hopeless sometimes when I see things, but we can't lose that hope, because then what do we have left?
Mm-hmm.